For all the yelling between creationists and scientists, there's one perspective that's largely absent from public discussions about evolution. The religious believers who accept the standard Darwinian account of evolution. It's a shame because there's an important question at stake. How can a person of faith justify that faith after Darwin? That's the question John Haught has set out to answer by proposing a theology of evolution. Haught's a Roman Catholic theologian at Georgetown University. Steve Paulson spoke with him.
For years, we've been bombarded by arguments over religion and evolution, and yet you say theology has not yet come to grips with Darwin. What are theologians missing?
The reason that there has been resistance, I mean, this has been probably one of the most dramatic events that theology, at least in the West, has ever had to face. The Darwinian story of evolution seems to give people a whole new creation story, different from the one that they had lived under for so many centuries.
You're talking about more than just the story of Genesis in the Bible. You're talking about a much bigger issue for most modern theology.
Yes, the story of Genesis has been hyped as the only problem. That's one of many aspects of the problem. I think the fundamental difficulty is the new evolutionary world in process, a world that's unfinished, a world that's still being created, the world that's still, you might say, every day comes up a little further above nothingness. It's so different from the cosmology that was the backbone or the backdrop of traditional spirituality and moral aspiration.
Now, I would have thought that the real challenge, the biggest challenge that evolutionary theory poses to most religions is the sense that there's no inherent meaning in the world. I mean, if you look at the process of natural selection, this apparently random series of genetic mutations, it would seem that there's no place for ultimate purpose there, that human beings are just an evolutionary accident.
In order to have a sense of meaning or purpose, there has to be some hierarchical structuring, you might say, of the cosmos. And when you come to the new scientific understanding of the universe, it seems that there are no sharp breaks between lifeless matter and life, between life and mind, and so that the traditional hierarchical structuring of meaning has become fluid, and it seems to many people that the new evolutionary picture of things places everything in the context of a meaningless smudge of stuff. Now, if you look at the new cosmography, it seems that mindless matter dominates the whole picture. You're right. Many intellectuals, many scientists, many biologists are convinced, as is Richard Dawkins, for example, and Stephen Jay Gould, that evolution has destroyed the notion of purpose. So one of the things that I try to do in my theology is to point out that that's not necessarily true at all.
Well, it would seem that there might be a simple response to this, that purpose is a matter for theologians and philosophers to argue about, but purpose is simply not a scientific word, that the two have nothing to do with each other. Do you accept that distinction?
I sure do, but I want to point out how that distinction is usually violated in scientific literature and in much discussion of evolution. I believe that science, from the beginning of the modern world, decided quite rightly that it wasn't going to tackle such questions as purpose, value, meaning, importance, or talk about God, or even talk about intelligence or subjectivity. It was going to look for purely natural, efficient, causal, mechanical explanations of things. But what happens is that that principle of scientific Puritanism is often violated by so-called experts who think that by dint of their scientific expertise, they are now able to comment on such things as purpose. And I consider that to be a great violation.
Give me examples of what you mean, of scientists who extrapolate about purpose from science.
Well, a good example is the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg, who in his book Dreams of a Final Theory says that once science gets down to what he calls the fundamental levels of reality, he asks, will we find God? And it's almost as though he assumes that science itself has the capacity, the prowess, the power, the right to comment on things like that. My view is that theology, instead of trying to ignore it or close its eyes to it or shove it in the drawer, should look it squarely in the face. And it has everything to gain and nothing to lose by doing so. And in my own work, what I try to do in my book, God After Darwin and Others, is to argue that in a sense, Darwin's thought is a gift to theology.
You're saying that it's forced theologians to sharpen their thinking?
Yes, and I came to this whole idea of evolutionary theology long, long ago when I was still a very, very young man. I read the works of a famous Jesuit paleontologist named Teilhard de Chardin. And Teilhard in the early 20th century was saying pretty much what I'm saying today. And Teilhard was sent by his superiors to study geology and paleontology. And he was a priest at the time, and he was trying to think, well, what does what I'm learning about the evolutionary character of life on Earth have to do with my Christianity? And he started writing essays synthesizing evolution into a very broad understanding of his faith. And his religious superiors thought that these essays that he was writing were just a bit too adventurous for the time, so they shipped him off to China, which is the wrong place to send people who like to dig up old bones, because Teilhard got involved in expeditions that uncovered Peking Man and other interesting evolutionary phenomena. And during all this time, 25 or so years in China, he was still trying to develop his ideas, synthesizing Christianity and evolution. And he was writing his major work, The Phenomenon of Man, now translated as The Human Phenomenon, but he could not get it published in his own lifetime because the church and his superiors were not ready for this, it seemed. But after he died, his lay friends took his works and they flooded the religious world with these publications. And it ended up that Teilhard had an enormous influence on religious thought, especially Catholic thought.
Didn't he make the point that the universe is still evolving? That's sort of the transformation that he was trying to chart. And he saw that in the natural world as well.
Yeah. What he did, and this is what a lot of biologists do not do, is he put the Darwinian chapters of the story of nature in the larger context of cosmic evolution. And he saw that you can, by anybody's standards, see an emergence of what he called more coming in from the time of the Big Bang, let's say. Atoms become molecules, molecules become cells, cells become organisms, organisms become vertebrates with a complex nervous system, nervous tissue develops and eventually becomes very, very complex in humans. And it raises the question, well, where is this process of complexification, which is accelerating today at an enormous pace because of communication technology, engineering, economics, politics. The globe is shrinking. We're able to connect instantaneously with other aspects of the Earth. We should expect and we should look for and hope for the universe to keep becoming more.
Earlier you said that cosmic purpose is a question that lies outside of science, but it sounds like you're bringing it into science here. There's this inexorable process towards more complexity, and if you want to look for purpose, whether it's evolution or whether it's within the larger universe, that's what it is.
Okay, we have to distinguish between science as a method and what science produces in the way of discovery. As a method, science does not ask the questions of purpose. And rightly so, it brackets those out. But when we look at the cumulative results of scientific thought as well as technology and so forth, then that's part of the world that we have to, from a theological point of view, integrate into our religious visions. And what is the purpose? The purpose seems to be, from the very beginning, the intensification of consciousness. And if you understand purpose as the actualizing of a value or the bringing about or realizing of something that's unquestionably good, then consciousness certainly fits. A universe which has been in the business from the very start of bringing forth a complexity which has a correlative intensity of consciousness is a pretty good universe.
John Haught is a Catholic theologian at Georgetown University. His books include God After Darwin and God and the New Atheism. He spoke with Steve Paulson. You'll find a transcript of Steve's entire interview with John Haught on our website at ttbook.org/scienceandmeaning.
For decades, the prevailing view of human evolution has been that it's over. That if you stripped off your clothes, you and I would actually look quite a lot like our Stone Age ancestors. Better hairstyles and dental hygiene. But at the University of Wisconsin, paleoanthropologist John Hawks runs a lab that's been coming up with new evidence to the contrary.
This would be an example of what we'd call a robust skull. So a robust skull has got stuff sticking out of it. It's got a brow ridge. You've got this ridge on the back, and there's this bar of bone over it. Teeth are quite large. Actually, let me run just a second. I'll get another skull so I can show you what I'm talking about.
And Strange Champs recently stopped by John Hawks' big, echoey bone lab to look at some human skulls and talk about how humans are evolving. Some changes, he told her, are obvious.
When we look at the kinds of things that skeletally have shifted in the last 10,000 years, you're looking at things that, some of them very noticeable. You know, the brain shrank. We got smaller heads in that last 10,000 years. You know, we're talking about, in Europe, the skull reduced in its volume by about 10%. So it's reduced by a lot. Why is it reduced? Well, this is sort of straightforward why it should reduce. The brain uses energy. It's about 20% of your minimum output in terms of energy use. That's a big cost. And if you could sort of cut that down a little bit, you'd have more energy for other stuff.
Or sort of like making a smaller, more efficient car.
Exactly right. It's exactly what it is.
We've evolved to be the hybrids.
It's exactly right. Now, think about how that could happen. It could happen just as it did in cars by getting the same horsepower out of a smaller engine. Uh-huh. Or it could happen by tolerating less horsepower.
I can't quite figure out if you're saying our brains are more powerful just in smaller cases or whether our brains are in fact lesser than
we don't
the brains
know.
Of our ancestors.
We don't know is the answer. So if I ask my students, why did the brain get smaller? The first answer is idiocracy. You know, people are getting dumber. The second answer is, well, maybe they're getting more efficient. Right. You know, maybe it's changed because we're doing more with less tissue.
Now, one thing that's striking is that we're sitting here in front of a pile of bones in your bone lab, but we're talking about genetic variation and genetic evolution. It strikes me that the job of a paleoanthropologist must be really different today.
Well, it's absolutely changed. You know, genetics today, you can look at the human genome on the genome browser. Anybody can do this. It's totally free. And you can look at variations in the genome. And so if we're, in my lab, plotting out parts of the genome that look like they've been impacted by selection, we'd say, well, what do they do?
Are there specific changes you can point to, specific way stations along the way?
Well, I think that, you know, the big event is the first agriculturalists. You know, when we settled down, started living in villages, started eating all these cereals, you know, we're eating wheat, in the New World they're eating corn. This is all stuff that hunter-gatherers are not good at. And so the best examples are things like lactase persistence. It's normal for mammals to drink milk when they're babies, but not when they're grown-ups. And so they, over the course of maturation, lose this ability to digest lactose. Well, some humans have the ability to continue that, the production of the enzyme lactase that lets that happen. That's a mutation. It happened, we now know, at least five times in different ancient human populations, all of them in the last few thousand years.
That's and why is that?
Because of the advantage. This is a population that depended on dairy animals to a greater or lesser extent, but only after they domesticated cattle, goats, sheep. So it's that domestication that creates a new environment. You're drinking milk because it's available to you. If you could just digest that sugar a little better, then you get a bonus, more energy out of it. And so the environmental change creates the opportunity for a genetic change.
So a genetic variation occurs. Some infants are born with this new gene that lets them digest lactose. Those infants have a better chance of surviving. They pass the gene on, and pretty soon you have a few generations later, you have a population that can digest milk easily.
Exactly right. So imagine a woman who's pregnant, and she has to maintain a high energy input to maintain a pregnancy or to maintain her own lactation. What difference would it make to get 30% more calories out of milk? Make a lot of difference.
Well, so far, in terms of the way humans are evolving, you've mentioned the ability to digest lactose. Mm-hmm. Any other major ways in which humans have evolved?
One of the kinds of genes that I'm real interested in my lab is genes that are related to the hair cells of the inner ears.
Why are you interested in that?
Well, so the inner ear is the part that hears things. And the hair cells don't make hairs. They have tiny, what are called stereocilia on top of them. And those stereocilia are what are essential to receiving sounds mm-hmm. in your ears. And it turns out that about a dozen or 20 of these genes in different human populations have changed under selection in the last 10 to 20,000 years. That's more than you'd expect
right.
from
and
chance.
So why would that be?
So why would it be? Well, we can run hypotheses, right? Hypothesis. The reason why these genes are selected is because humans are adapting to language in some way. You know, they have to hear words better. We know that humans hear a different range of sound sensitivities than chimpanzees do. So we know that there's been change. Maybe we're becoming better at it. Maybe when you start living in cities, you have to be able to recognize different voices better. Mm. And so there's a social aspect to it. Maybe it has to do with the kinds of languages that you're speaking in different populations. And so maybe they're tone languages or not. So lots of hypotheses.
You know, I know anthropologists have a very different sense of time than the rest of us. But when you're talking about human evolution and the fact that it's speeding up, how fast might you actually see that playing out? You know, the proverbial grandparent who said, oh, kids today are not what they used to be. Are they right?
If we look at people that we dig out of the ground 5,000 years ago in Germany, not one of them that we've found so far has the gene that allows lactose digestion.
Just 5,000 years?
Just 5,000 years ago. If we look at people who lived in the Ukraine about 3,000 years ago, about 20% of them had it. Today, in Germany, 80% or higher. That means that 95% of people can digest this. They carry at least one copy of it.
So that's a change that happened in 3,000 years or
that's
less.
That's a change that happened in 3,000 years or less. If we measure people's teeth 3,000 years or less, there's been a big difference. I mean, it's that kind of thing where we can say that we are not the same people that the Romans were. We have different genes today. And that's what has been going on, by our estimates, for thousands of human genes.
We're also living through another period of enormous transition as we move, you know, out of the old industrial economy and civilization into the new world of multimedia. Is that likely to produce another big, fast pile of evolutionary changes?
The easy answer to that question, but the one that sort of ends the discussion, is, well, we're going to start genetically engineering people. And then, of course, things speed up because the potential for change is much higher. You know, now it's not just you wait for the random change to happen. You choose the change. And once that takes off, you can only imagine what will be possible.
John Hawks is a paleoanthropologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He talked with Anne Strangechance in his lab.
You can ask me, mister, because I know. Tell them soul-sucking preachers to come on down and see. Pardon man, pardon monkey, baby, that's me.
For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, What Does Evolution Want? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Original theme music for the series was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on this series and to find additional material about the topics we've explored, please go to our website at ttbook.org/scienceandmeaning. And special thanks to two of our sponsors for Science and the Search for Meaning, the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, and Promega Corporation.
providing tools and technologies for research in life science.
PRI, Public Radio International.